My name is Scott Nagley. I'm the chair of the juvenile subcommittee. I'd like to ask for a motion to commence the meeting.
Peter Maury, second motion, or propose we start the meeting.
Yes, second.
Ben Galarno, second.
Thank you. Okay, hi, I believe this is our third gathering of meetings that we've had so far. When we met last time, we were in the process of trying to come and talk about, oh, I'm sorry, thank you, yep. Let me back up and do roll call. Jenna, can you assist us with that?
Yes. All right, so Chairman Nagley is present. Excuse is Mr. Barney. Mr. Galarno?
Present.
Dr. Maury?
Present.
Ms. Oppenheim?
Present.
Yep.
Yep.
I'm sorry, I'm gonna work on it.
No, there's lots of.
So you have a quorum.
Thank you. All right, returning to the old business, we were talking about other states' standards and processes as related to the pre-sentence part of the process. I don't know if we have more that we needed to talk to about other stuff. I did, like I said I would, and I reached out to a colleague in Canada to try to garner a little bit of information about their processes with respect to both adults and juveniles. I made a brief report about what he had to say regarding the adults in the adult court system yesterday in the adult committee. If it's okay with the group assembled, I'd like to just read a brief paragraph that Dr. James Worling sent me regarding the processes for juveniles in Canada. So I'm going to do that, and then we can perhaps have a discussion about that. For youth, the age of responsibility in Canada is 12, so our youth system is applied to those who offended when they were between the ages of 12 and 17, inclusive. As with adults, we don't have any national rules or regulations regarding who does assessments, how they conduct them, or how interventions are delivered. In the most populous province, Ontario, where I live and work, we also don't have any provincial standards, rules, or guidelines regarding the assessment or treatment of youth who have offended sexually. As well as you can imagine, it is highly variable what happens for a teen who has committed a sexual offense in Canada. I think what he's trying to say is probably each province, maybe even smaller than that, cities and municipalities in those provinces are probably doing things in very different ways, some of which is probably anchored in good science, as I know it would be with respect to Jim in Ontario. Not sure I could comment on whether that's being done qualitatively in other places to the extent that I know Jim and his colleagues in Ontario are doing that, but it is a marked contrast to what probably already exists here in Arizona and in the states broadly. Something that, you know, the very existence of this board, I think, highlights maybe some of the differences between our state and Canada in general. Can't help but wonder if not doing it on some level in Canada is concern about things becoming over-prescriptive and those kinds of things. Jim did opine here in his email to me, and I'd also like to read that just because I think it's important for us to consider all alternatives and all perspectives as we move forward in trying to do justice to this cause. So I'm going to read what he said, and perhaps this stimulates some discussion as well. He said, "From an outsider, it often seems like the U.S. tends to see those who commit sexual crimes as highly unique and somewhat homogeneous. For example, I have heard of several states with sex offender management boards, but I have never heard of such an organization for people who murder other people or who set fires. I also never hear about youth having to take a polygraph unless they have offended sexually. I'm not saying that there aren't unique issues related to the assessment and treatment of those who commit sexual crimes, But it does feel like sexual crimes are treated very differently in your land versus my land. This is perhaps why we don't have specific guidelines, management boards, etc. It does raise some interesting issues, right? I mean, we certainly have lots of people who cause harm to other people, and we collectively seem to have made some decisions as systems to intervene or to respond to or to implement interventions with this group of clients in a very different way than we have probably everybody else. Not sure what people's thoughts are about that.
Did he have any thoughts about why that works?
I don't know that I went back to him and had further dialogue with him. This was just an email correspondence, certainly something that I intend to go back and have more dialogue with him about. I mean, I have a good sense of some of his responses because we know each other pretty well, and I've known him for 30 years and used him as a resource to help me with difficult situations across time. I think he says a lot in the last sentence of this paragraph, in trying to be thoughtful. I think that those are both reasonable questions. I mean, why we do it differently with sex offenders is philosophically an interesting question.
So, Peter Maury, I'm trying so hard not to laugh out loud right now because we were founded by Puritans, guys. I mean, it's just who we are. We're so sex negative in this country that anything to deal with sex is so purulent and scandalous and money making that, it's blown out of proportion for entertainment, for character suicide or character assassination, all of that. And so European standards, Australian standards, Canadian standards don't apply in our own system. I really think it's funny to have a murder management board, but I also hate to suggest that because the lawyer part of me is saying that's just opening the door to way too much governmental overreach. So I think, and my part on the, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that I think in this, and what I liked about the guiding principles of juveniles, is that we assume they're going to get better through treatment. And I think we need to carry on that same attitude with adults, because sex offenders in America are a really easy political football. I mean, politicians and gain so much mileage from a really easy target, and we're creating a marginalized burden. And yeah, what they do is terrible. Do they need treatment? Absolutely. Do they need some sort of management of a cohesive system to help people through that? Absolutely. But I think that we shouldn't throw a person out for one thing that happened. I mean, if it's a serial thing that keeps happening, they don't progress through treatment and they don't progress through probation, absolutely, they're making their own bed there. But we need to have some system that a person is not going to be defined by this one act or even several acts or one period of their life. We don't do that to murderers. We don't do that to arsonists. We don't do that to even drunk drivers who maybe commit heinous crimes that affect families for years, if not generations. So I think we need to look at this rationally from a humanistic perspective of, okay, how do we respect the victim, take care of them, respect their rights, not re-traumatize them by, like there was a suggestion yesterday at the adult meeting of having the victims recontacted if a person is going to maybe get off of registration at some point. Well, if a person's 15, 20 years past this and has a life, do you really want to re-traumatize them by bringing them back to their perpetrator? We need to think about all of those things in a holistic fashion and work both sides of the fence here, which is the tough balancing act that we have. So there's my soapbox.
Yeah. No, I think a lot of what you're saying is kind of what Jim's probably getting at by you know, some of the statements that he's making, the questions that he's raising. But I've said before in our prior meetings that I want something meaningful to come out of this, obviously, but I don't want us to rush so much that we end up coming up with things that are more problematic than what we already have. I want us to be thoughtful about this. I want us to be thorough about this. I want us to create enough of an environment, both in this room and in the larger committee, that we can talk about some difficult things, and to truly have those vetted, and for enough dialogue to take place that we're a largely informed body making largely informed decisions.
Peter Maury, I completely agree with that. And I also think that we need to come up with something that's realistic, so that we don't create necessarily the easy way, but we create a continuum that will actually work across the system. Because I think a lot that we have in place doesn't work because we don't talk to each other. In other words, the agencies don't know what each other is doing or how the system works. So we can come up with all kinds of great stuff in treatment. The probation guys are going to be like, yeah, great, but we can't do that. So I think those are things we need to be sensitive of in the subcommittees to say, okay, let's take this back so we can get meaningful input, as you were saying, to create something that actually works.
Yeah, and I think that that's part of what's behind this subcommittee's having people come in to talk to us and to share information regarding their particular vantage point of the larger system. We're going to come to that discussion as we sit here today, but we have people lined up to come hopefully to the next two meetings from different state agencies to talk about their system's responsibilities and their system's way of doing things and responding to these issues with kids and families who have these issues. I think we all need to hear that information so that we can have more dialogue around those issues. We certainly have in this room enough capacity to make our way through some of those system challenges and roadblocks and perhaps even conflicts if we take the time to do that. But we're going to need to have buy-in from everybody in a more complete way to do justice to this task.
And Laura, well, that's the beauty of us all being here in town. That's right. We're going to get to people. And I think certainly having a system in place is better than not a system. At minimum, it gives you a chance to get a data what we're doing.
I mean, my guess is, no, this is Scott Nagley again. I suspect, and it will be borne out or not borne out in more discussion that I have with Dr. Rowland, but I know him well enough to know that he has something in place, and that it's research driven and it's science driven, and that he's doing that as he interfaces with kids and families who have these issues. Whether or not there's any state or government oversight or provincial oversight that outlines things, I think that's probably what he's talking about. But I'm confident that in his interactions with kids and families with these issues, he has a system, and it's a well thought out system, and one that has been born to create less recidivism. And he's probably one of a half a dozen people who's studied recidivism rates with juveniles more than anybody else. And I think there's evidence that his programming is in fact working.
So yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, Peter Maury, and this kind of circles all the way back to why we're here with the risk means responsivity, is that I think that model is really appropriate for us to move forward with of, okay, you know, what happened, what can we do to make this not happen again, rather than just your bad luck, yeah. And so I think we definitely need a system, we definitely need the research base, we definitely need individual, as much as we can, assessment to figure out how we're going to move people forward with the expectation of them getting better, not praying.
Yeah, and back to the place where we started this subcommittee, similar to the adult subcommittee, talking about the pre-sentence assessment piece of this. Assessment by its very nature should be drawing distinctions between one person and the next, making recommendations that are as individualized as they can possibly be. So anything other than that that's being called assessment, from my humble perspective, is not assessment. It's cookie cutter. It's repetitive, and it does not take into account individual responsivity factors of individual kids and their families. So.
I mean, I'm just a practicing kids. Comments and I you know, Jim knows well as you for 30 years as well and know well this work. I guess I just keep going to you know talking about the bullets for other types of individuals and an arsonist. You know, they get caught two or three times, they're not able to reoffend by burning more houses down. A murderer, if they're doing it more than once and they're committing homicides, they are typically shut down and not allowed to just keep trying and get treatment. But with offenders, there's a lot of, I think when it comes to sex offending, there could be a lot more victims. You know, if there's a serial killer, then that's a little bit different. And yes, they're treated like a serial killer. But yeah, there's not going to be a board for the one guy that gets mad and kills his girlfriend, you know. But I mean, what the stat used to be, 1 in 3 people was a sex offense victim. So I don't want to minimize the fact that we have a board to help our people. So I again don't want it to be this way and too extreme, but I don't want to be, and I know Canada, you know, I know how they, and for him to say, like, we don't really have something, but you're right, he has something.
Yeah.
Too bad everybody in Canada doesn't adopt his thing.
Yeah.
But I don't want to get to where we all do something different in this county, you bet, for two different counties. So imagine everybody already doing stuff, but if we didn't even have probation on board or we didn't have judges on board, it would be that much more chaotic. And yeah, some kids would get the shaft, and some kids wouldn't get accountability at all, you know. So I kind of see it somewhere in the middle, but, you know, saying why don't we have boards for other people? I think when it comes to sex offending, you can have a lot of damage in a lot of years. And so, I don't know, I mean, the victims are, you know.
And just going to jump in and play devil's advocate on that really quickly. And this is from wearing the two hats, the psychiatrist and the SVP attorney. Pyromania is a mental illness. Psychopathy is a mental illness. You know, we see a lot of other specified paraphilic disorder non-consent. So we've got legitimate mental illnesses that may drive these. And yeah, we've got 1 in 3 because, you know, drunk stepdad diddles his daughter. Research shows he's probably never going to do that again. You've got the guy who loses his cool and blows somebody away in a second degree murder. He's probably never going to do it again either. So I agree with you that there's got to be some distinction or some board or some mechanism to tease out who may be a one-time offender and who's going to go on and be a serial pyromaniac. But we need to build that into the system that we're talking about. It starts the evaluation that Sal is talking about, and that's how we individualize it from there. I think that what we had talked about with the one size fits all, absolutely, I agree with you, can't do that and can't not have a system. So,
and I don't know numbers, I'm not a big stats, I don't know numbers that may or may not be accurate, but there's not as many pyromaniacs as there are people who are sex offenders. And I've worked with juveniles. And I can say in almost 30 years that I've almost never had somebody that just had one victim and never did it again. So I don't see those kids. Maybe it's because the people that come to me aren't just the one time, but I think it's rare that just a kid does it once, gets caught, and it's never about doing it again or doesn't have more victims.
And I think I don't know if it's framed this way that they terminates way that it suggests that the board is bad. Right.
Yeah, I don't think
when the board can be a good thing, we can address some of those.
Sure.
We can establish bonds here, but that's the worst thing treated that thing instead of not having anything. Prosecutor gets the fancy. So I think boards can be good things. I think they should be good properly. It's important.
Peter Moy, I totally agree with you 100%, and I think we absolutely need this board. And yeah, it's a really good thing.
But at the same time, Scott Nagley, but at the same time, I think it's important to ask ourselves philosophical questions about how did we get here? Did we get here for all the right reasons and all the risk-based reasons and all the just reasons? Or did we get here through other forces, such as you alluded to, you know, in the statement you made a short while ago? I think you're correct. I think that that is a piece of why we've gotten here and are sitting here having this discussion. I think there is a way to balance the need for community safety, the need for justice for victims, and the need for well-assessed risk of individual young people who are engaging in sexually abusive behavior. I think we have the methodology to do that. Whether or not we can convince people collectively that that makes sense, that's yet unanswered question. In particular, the piece of that equation that involves the use of polygraph testing. That one, from my perspective, turned into something that I don't think ever really existed in an operational sort of way. And those of us that tend to support the use of polygraph never really got a chance to comment about the advantages of it and to counter comment some of the abuses that were being sold as commonplace when polygraphs are getting done. It didn't happen that way. And from my perspective, and I think some of my colleagues' perspectives, the issue of polygraph in the state of Arizona became a political issue, and it got rammed through without any real meaningful dialogue about that. And we need to have that dialogue as part of this process. And if that means I ask Ben here to come and give a presentation about his process with respect to juveniles as part of us bringing people in to share their information from their perspective, then we need to do that too.
Peter Mori, I think that would actually be good. I mean, I'm kind of where you are with polygraphs, but I think Melanie said it correctly that we know a lot more individually than we know as the collective right now. And so more education we get in being able to share all that information. So I think having that present would be great, just so we know. So I'll admit I don't know the specifics of the polygraph, and I honestly don't know the entire controversy behind it, but I think as part of the tool, it's absolutely should be included in both the adult and juvenile.
Yeah, and when I say what I say about the use of polygraph, that includes protecting individuals' rights against self-incrimination. I mean, that includes all of that stuff. I'm not naive to those concerns. In fact, I was part of a subcommittee 25 years ago that wrote the current statute around those that are adjudicated having built-in legal protections, you know, once they've been adjudicated, about making other disclosures in the course of their treatment. I get that. I think that's important too. And we need to balance those realities as part of this equation too. But to not have meaningful dialogue about it is a mistake. It's an error.
So if I may, Peter Mori, where should we start then?
I
could keep talking about this all day. So.
Yeah. Well, I think we move on to the next item on the.
Absolutely.
I think we move on to the next item on the agenda, which is the discussion of the guiding principles. I'm not sure where to start that discussion, other than I believe that these guiding principles are the Colorado state guiding principles as it relates to juveniles.
It's like the succinct version that I read last time, I think.
It is. Yeah.
Well, Ben Gilmore, I don't know, have you all looked around at the other boards? I've been watching, I saw something that said there's about 17 states that have something that looks like a board. Not all states are calling them boards, like Texas is a county. And they don't have something for the guiding principles, which is if we kind of treat sex offenders, and we refer to this statute, we refer to this, and this statute. So it's really across the board. This and Colorado, Idaho seem to have kind of a document that started guiding for the rest of the whole thing. But a lot of states are doing it differently. Colorado and Idaho is doing pretty similar.
Hi, Scott Nagley. I had got verification in the adult subcommittee meeting, which took place yesterday, that these were in fact the Colorado standards. I raised the issue today because I think it's an important one. That I think we need something like this, and I don't think that there's anything wrong with using these as points of departures. But I'm not a lawyer, but I do have concerns about us making this part of, you know, reviewable stuff on our website without us getting a blessing from the people that we got the information from.
Mr. Chairman, Jenna Mitchell.
Jenna.
I did speak with Chairwoman Golden, and she did receive these directly from Colorado, and they did share them freely, knowing that we would be considering and or adopting their guiding principles. So I think we have an answer for you on that.
That's a good answer. I feel a lot more comfortable about us. Because I know that at least my sense is that the Chairman Golden wants to try to move forward with some of this guiding principle stuff as quickly as possible. I concur with that, but I think we need to make sure that everybody's had a chance to review these thoroughly. And then we can have a discussion about what in here seems to hold true for us here in Arizona and what might need to be tweaked a bit and what needs to be perhaps dropped from this. I don't know. So I don't know what the next step with respect to that is, other than and to encourage all of us sitting at this table to do that.
Peter Mark, are we looking at Idaho too? And maybe, so I know the last meeting, Blake gave us a pretty good summary of Idaho, what they have going on. It sounds like they have some pretty good system built up. I personally haven't read the guiding principles.
These are right in Idaho.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it goes off in the next book.
Can we get these? Could Ben submit this to you guys and absolutely. Have you guys distribute it to all of us so that we have access to it?
Yeah. Absolutely. Jenna Mitchell, are those the documents that Blake provided in the last meeting for the adults?
No, I printed this off.
You printed it off? Yeah, okay.
This morning.
Okay.
There's like, I think there's 20 or 18. I mean, they're pretty simple, right? We're saying a lot of the same stuff here.
Yeah, and what I'm kind of wondering is if we can put those up to all of us and review them before we have that connection, we can discuss any differences what we think may be able to mesh between the two and add to go, and then we don't.
Point of clarification, if I can ask a question, when we say put them up, we're just talking about disseminating them to the
community. Yeah, that's right.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you for that point of clarification.
I think there's getting nods of heads that they can absolutely do that, so that'll be helpful. I mean, we could also take time in our very busy schedules to try to do some more searches, but I concur with Ben. I found approximately 17 states. Of some version of what we're trying to create here. They are in varying degrees of operational, I would say, and in varying degrees have a whole lot of substance to them. There's Colorado on one end of the continuum down to some other states that, other than a statement of that they have something of a board, I don't see much else going on. That was my cursory review of things. So we'll make that happen, and we'll be prepared to have more discussion about that. We are at some point going to have to make some decisions about biting the bullet and who's going to do some writing and those kinds of things. I wish, if I may ask another question, Jenna, is there any way, because I've been thinking this and maybe it just crystallized in my brain right here, is there anybody that could take that task on to look at those other 17 things and try to summarize what exists and doesn't exist in those other places in a in a more consumable manner for those of us that are part of these subcommittees and the larger committee. It's just so much. I don't know how somebody other than somebody who's dedicated to doing that is going to be able to pull that off.
Jenna Mitchell, I don't think that our current staff, it's a very small staff, has the capacity to do that for you. Certainly, if you send us documents, we can distribute them to you all. We can combine them for you. We can help you put together a document, but not to do the independent research and collect, 17 different states' guiding principles. I don't think we have the time or the staff in support of two subcommittees and the whole
thing. I suspected that was probably the case.
Happy to help.
But I also then wonder, in response to that, is that an oversight in the structure of our process that we don't have the ability to do that? I'm just asking a question. I had concerns about about workload and those kinds of things as this started to unfold, and then it ends up landing on us a few select people who already don't have time to do all that. But
that'd go on out. Well, there's only under 17 states. Maybe they break them up. I would assume that most states did what we're doing now. See a lot of Colorado stuff in Idaho. We're just everyone's kind of done what we did, and I think we're going to find some pretty similar stuff. Right? Community safety, big family, region thunder. It's all that kind of stuff. And first, I don't think we need to read the wheel. Some of the stuff we could probably just take straight from here without as far as plagiarizing goes, I don't know. Jenna, do we have permission to actually just take verbatim stuff from them and consider that we need to?
I would, Jenna Mitchell, because I'd want to verify that with Colorado, but from what Chairwoman Golden expressed to me, she did have permission. I know she and I have both been in contact with the program manager in Colorado for resource documents, support, things like that. So I don't think there will be a problem, but I would, to Chairman's point, want to just confirm that with them, that we have permission to use it and or, rebrand it with Arizona's name on it.
So then, Scott Nagle, in the spirit of doing what Mr. Galarno is suggesting here, perhaps I can send an email to staff with the list of states that have some sort of structure that they're calling a management board, and we can do exactly what you're saying, but then take three or four of them and spend a little bit more time going into those. With the permission of the group, I'll take the liberty of doling those out if that's okay with everybody.
Sure.
Okay.
Sounds good. Then Peter, one quick thought. I wonder if there's regional variation. Like, does New York do it differently than Washington?
Guess we'll find out, right?
Yeah, it'd be interesting.
Yeah. And like you said, some of the states I have built. Where is this stuff? Some of it's under EPS and it's under the Department of Corrections. And it wasn't just right there, like these were.
No, it's not easy to source for sure. That I found out really quickly, but that's the case.
Peter, Mark, going back to our original discussion, that's why we're here.
Okay, so we'll do that between now and when we sit together next. I'll get a list of the states that have some form of board. I will, with the help of staff, reach out to each of you about which states I'd like you to take the time to do a bit more research on, and I will do the same with whichever ones I keep for myself, so to speak. And we'll be prepared to come back and talk about that some more than the next time we come here.
No, Neil, I still have Tom Lemercy that's welcome. He's offered several times to fill me in or tell me what they did wrong or what they did right. And so it's pretty willing, and I can't help him in other ways.
I know who he is, but clarify for the group who he is.
More recently, I mean, he's been a big part of ATSA, the conference that Scott and I've gone to for some years, but I'm not sure if he was ever on the ATSA board. He's never the president, but he's been kind of one of the guiding forces of a lot of the guidelines that came out of the national it's the national guidelines for ASSA. More recently, the AOC, who I deal with, the Office of the Courts, and especially the juvenile portion, has used him as a reference, referral, trainer. I mean, I trained all the probation officers last year with him coinciding. So he's definitely somebody that Arizona looks to, and which kind of helps me because I don't agree with everything in Colorado. Case in point is the polygraph. But the fact that the AOC already kind of buys him, that's who I deal with. That's who my biggest contractor is, my funding source. So it kind of helps me know he's already in, he's already got a well-established voice in the field. So.
Yeah, he's been an integral figure in a committee of people from ASSA, the Association for the Treatment of Sexual Abusers, who rewrote the guidelines for assessment, supervision, and treatment for juveniles that came out a couple years ago. And a piece of that, as Melanie said, had to do with the use of polygraph. And just so I can say it on the record, they didn't say not to use the polygraph. They essentially said only in specific, unique cases and with input from the court. And that piece of it feels right to me. We could probably have a discussion about where the line gets drawn, about how we decide who we do and don't polygraph, because I don't think there's ever been any discussion about that. There would be some, though we could have a lively debate in this room, I'm sure, about whether or not we think everybody needs to be polygraphed. And perhaps we need to have that discussion, whether that be now or at some other point in time, because I definitely have thoughts and feelings about that. So, I mean, ASSA didn't say no. They largely said no, though. And the voice was loud enough that it influenced state agencies to adopt.
Judges and defense attorneys are our biggest. So AOC says, no, go ahead and do it. There's this many steps, this much paperwork now you have to do. But what the defense attorneys have and what the judges kind of have been influenced on is that ASSA said it was bad. So that's kind of the bottom line, is there was an overall feel from ASSA and the guidelines that this man wrote, that even though we can do them, it's very difficult. I mean, I've had several therapists that are very concerned about clients, our kids, and when requesting a polygraph like we were asked to do, it gets shot down, or it takes months and they still get shot down. So that's
no, certainly a perception of polygraph was created by the process that unfolded that has left the judicial and certainly defense attorneys with a lot of resistance, and I don't think justifiably so, but those are discussions to be had.
Yeah, Ben Gallardo, I think we just need to, as I mentioned in the last meeting, kind of redefine what polygraph is, explain, re-educate, because people start in this premise that it's abusive, and then we go from it. You know, I was reading one of these statutes here, so if you're using a polygraph, proceed with caution. My first question was, why? Whoever wrote that, tell me why. I bet they would be hard-pressed, you know, involved, because that's what I heard, should proceed with caution. You know, there's this perception on the word came from, but it's, if it's done properly, it's very effective. And I think the only place that you could criticize it would be the post-test, right, after somebody fails. Because the American Polygraph Association says the interview should be objective, non-biased, and with any opinions, very, you know, matter of fact in your interview. And then you sit down in the chair for about 10 minutes and a couple of electrodes, you know, five or six, seven questions, and then you're done. I mean, that whole, I can see anybody looking at that, well, that's abusive. It's an interview like they have with a, you know, or a therapist or anybody else, and they sit down and answer some questions. So that third part, you know, we kind of made some policy about how do we deal with assaults. And we could tweak that out. You know, we can make guidelines and think, how do we question? How do we let them know they won't do it? Do we let them? Maybe the therapist lets them. You know, but there's a lot of things we could do there, and that's the only part that I can see that people have criticism. And I'm sure somewhere along the line, you know, there was some player who just wasn't doing a good job, and maybe they were abusive and infuriated, and you pressed too hard, and we can deal with that policy. And we can have board certified juvenile polygraphers who are trained that way. You don't do this line of question. You might say something, I'm not sure how you're going to do this question. It's like, I'm going to have some issues here. And the juveniles are pretty easy to start talking once you point out they're not doing. Up until that point, they'll tell you no a million times. But if you go, you know what? Looks like you might not be doing something on this question. I'll comment. Then they start. It's not difficult. We can deal with that. But
there's a whole discussion in what you just said about the utility of the polygraph in terms of what it can facilitate. It becomes a more integral part of the kid's ongoing treatment. There's all these cautionary things that have come up across time about the use of polygraph. But as you said, and I agree with you, Ben, give me an example of that you know from your own experience. And the people who are saying those things can't give you an example of that.
They can't, that's what.
And so there's a lot of folklore about what this is and how it's used and how it's caused trauma and how it's resulted in other charges being filed, none of which in 30 years am I cognizant of.
I wish I could say, and I'm not trying to get off the topic of polygraphs, but it is not solely polygraphs. This month, three different kids who are needed to be in assessments and psychosocial evaluations, the teams have said, no, it will be traumatizing. No, it will be traumatic. So we're not just dealing with these guys being traumatized. Now it's gone so far as we cannot make an assessment. We have kids in wrong, sometimes DCS programs with no treatment available, that my therapists are begging for an assessment before we get them into treatment, and they're saying the kid doesn't want to, or the team thinks it would be traumatic. So it's kind of a shift of everything, like asking a kid a question.
I didn't realize.
Is abusive. So it's taken from there. And then my last year of treatment with my therapist is taking a whole new role. Like, okay, now everything's abusive. And, you know, I have therapists that are almost fallen. The way we deal with things is very upfront and accountability. And we've been accused of being too mean to our kids, you know? Not really, but you know what I mean? Like, it's just a whole different, there's a different lens. And maybe it's just with kids because I don't deal with the adult world, but that's what I'm dealing with on the day. That was yesterday. I got a call by another team that said they would never let this kid take an assessment because it's too traumatized to answer questions about his offenses.
We think they're doing them something.
They do. They do. So that's the bigger issue.
10 years now when they're an adult person.
And that's what we try to tell them is we like our kids. You meet him once a month for 20 minutes and you think you're doing him a favor, but I swear to you, he's gonna end up in the adult system because he's not learning that he cannot do these things. We're trying to help with that, you know?
Peter Maury, actually, Ben, the more we're sitting here talking, the more I would like you to do that presentation just clear up some of the myths we have about polygraph. So I guess I'll go ahead on the record saying I'm for it, but I don't totally understand how it works or what you can do. So I can see from the therapist hat, I absolutely want polygraph. I know what's going on, fact check with them. The lawyer side of me is saying, okay, hold on, but if you're doing this interview, I can also see how you could frame it where a person could be coercive to get answers out of the kid. So, you know, I've got pulling both thoughts in my head. Like, you know, I couldn't see asking questions about intent from a therapist's point of view. Yeah, I absolutely want to know that from a medical doctor point of view. I'm like, well, crap, that's loaded because everybody's anxiety is in a basis physiological reaction from a lawyer point of view. I'd be like, yeah, that's great.
And see what happens when we end up talking about this more. Things get articulated that are important for us to respond to, like you wouldn't have realized that we don't test for intent.
Right.
We exactly. Only test on behaviors. But you can't ask questions about intent.
Right, but that's where I think a lot of, yeah, especially prosecutors are in the middle, is okay, we want a polygraph on intent, or even defense attorneys, because they don't know. So I think, and that's where I kind of started with, so I would like that presentation, so we have enough record of what we do know about polygraphs, so it shows how we're, you know, considering this, taking a considered view of it.
I know that Jim Hanrahi, were you at the presentation when Jim presented?
Yeah.
I'm just saying, it would have to be different, just because people are probably like, we already heard about polygraphs. definitely gearing towards the juvenile end of it, because somebody did ask, how does this relate to juveniles?
I think it was Judge Young that might have asked that
question. It was a pretty quick response. Jim did go into it. We were kind of out of time. So I just don't want to, I'm not setting you up. I'd love to hear you talk, but I don't want the team going like, didn't we already do this? You know?
I was actually just talking about us.
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
No, so it's like, I just didn't take much debate for it because I'm stationed here about it too, though, eventually.
But having said that, this is Scott. And having said that, nothing changes unless it goes through the full board. So we can, I mean, we're going to sit here and we're going to do the work we need to do, and we're going to come up with recommendations and such, but it still has to pass muster with the full board. So if the full board isn't fully in the know about things that there are going to be discussions about, how could they possibly weigh in a meaningful sort of way?
We do our job and we take it back, and if they need to hear from Ben an extra 15 minutes, they do.
Yes. I think we just ask for permission to have that be part of the larger committee. Yeah.
Once we go with our,
if we could, you know, Bengalara, we could, as far as the polygraphs and attorneys involved, it's rare with the juveniles that we do a polygraph. Did you do something? That's the defense attorney. And a lot of times we're doing them with juveniles, we're doing it part of a psychosexual evaluation that somebody's requested. And with those, you have a statute here in Arizona that provides immunity to some extent of any admissions made once you're in treatment.
Once you're adjudicated.
So in those situations, we make it very clear that we don't want to identify any information on the basic information. But usually we're not doing a lot of pre-adjudication, so it's simply after adjudicated, we're making it. Because there can be some problems with the adjudication process with that. That's where you're going to get calls from the defense attorney saying,
Scott Nagley, having said that, I will tell you that I've had a fair amount of experience working with defense attorneys on juvenile cases, and they are supportive of my use of the polygraph in the evaluations, and they know that we are going to attend to the concerns that they have as well, as you just articulated, Ben, but that we really want the information because it helps us do a more comprehensive risk assessment, and it helps us make decisions about what the needs of this individual kid are from an intervention standpoint. We have risk assessment scales that have been designed both for adults and for juveniles. And the information, scoring somebody on a risk assessment scale is only as meaningful as the information that you have. And in the absence of lots of information, you're going to invariably under-evaluate somebody's risk. Because if you're an ethical person, you're going to score them no, unless you have information that it's yes on certain variables on a risk assessment scale. The problem is that you have people using scales as if they mean something when they don't have comprehensive information about the case that's sitting in front of them. That's a problem. That's a problem. And they don't have much specificity then either with respect to what are the levels of concern. Is it an issue of deviancy, bona fide deviancy with this kid? Is it an issue of antisociality with this kid? Where do substance issues play a part in this? And how do all those things coalesce together to either determine somebody to be more or less risky?
Well, frankly, development stage.
For sure.
13-year-old.
For sure.
That's the psychological profile of an 8-year-old.
In behavior X, we know what behavior X is. We don't know whether behavior X means the same thing for the 12-year-old as it does for the 16-year-old.
Ben Galara, I tell you one of the things about this business that I've seen as far as the legal side. Some counties will require a polygraph as part of the assessment, and they will require the person pass the polygraph before they give it in consideration. When that happens, when you're dealing with an evaluator, they will their evaluation, and they will call me directly and ask for a follow-up. They get the information. They can use that information for their evaluation. When you're dealing with evaluators, if you do not polygraph, they will do the evaluation, say if they don't polygraph, lawyer, you get me a polygraph, give it to me, and then use that. So a lawyer called me and said, hey, this kid's got a great evaluation, low risk, right? I'll say the specific example, you know, take a lot of them. They have a great evaluation, he's getting ready to go off to really good Ivy League school, bad knees. He inappropriately touched on the foreign exchange student one time. Prosecutor said that he gets an evaluation, we're not going to charge him with Ivy League school bad. But I need a polygraph. So I just need to put the nail in the coffin, everything else looks great. He's going to anticipate any problem. Now, when that happens, the lawyer gets my report. Lawyer can do what they want to do. So this kid comes in, to make a long story short, had been sexually assaulting foreign exchange students for years, started doing when he was about 13 years old, and he had raped some girls in high school off the field that were dating each other. So this polygraph goes to the attorney, and I get called by the attorney and starts screaming at him. He says, what did you do? You made my client look like Jeffrey Dahmer. I said, this is very concerning. And he said, he threatened legal action. He said, you tell the psychologist about this polygraph, any information, you're in big trouble. He goes, shred your material. I don't want to hear from you or about this again, right? Okay. So probably what happened is the lawyer probably sent him to six different places when he got lucky and got a passed polygraph. He gave that to the psychologist. He said, yeah, this is just what I thought. And the kid probably went off to school, and I would assume there's... So having that built into the evaluation, you must include a polygraph. The evaluator at least gets to see it. You know, and I would think if you're a psychologist doing an evaluation, just, you know, for lots of reasons, you would want to at least look at the information. You don't have to use it. You don't have to build it into your assessment, but at least look at the information, because that's the kind of stuff that comes up. I have probably been threatened by 30 or 40 attorney in juvenile tests because of that process. And if it had just been built in, you could have avoided all that. That kid probably never would have gone off to school. He probably sure. He knows it.
Peter Murray, again, a couple thoughts, and I totally agree with you 100% about the polygraph, and that's why I said the treatment side of me is important. And the lawyer side of me, I get it, and I think going back to the adult subcommittee yesterday, I think I hit off Ms. Higgins' head about she made a very optimistic view of lawyers' comment. And I was like, yeah, no, they don't do that because we're not trained to do that. And we're trained to fight, you know, right up until sentencing. And so the question yesterday in the adult subcommittee is, okay, we're going through the process, you know, kind of looking at it as it goes along. When do we do the evaluation? And this is something we're going to face too. And one of the things was kicked around is, okay, what if we build a judicial package that is done, you know, pre-sentence, but post-adjudication. So it goes to the lawyer for their consideration of sentencing, and we include the polygraph, we include the evaluation, and then, you know, deliver it to the lawyer sort of afterwards to say, okay, well, here's what we found in the client. But the adjudication that I got there to go through, not, it just goes toward the sentencing, it goes toward the treatment. But I think there's some validity to it because, you know, as a lawyer, can't trust lawyers, but that's what we're trying to do, and we're trying to do what's best for our client, be it the state or the defense, and things like what you just explained happen. So I think that's one consideration of practical reality.
Well, I think Scott Nagley, I think the good thing that we can be pretty confident about is, though there was some recent stuff going on that probably gets me to balk at what I'm about to say, but the post dismissal agreements that were happening in the juvenile court where there wasn't any evaluation going on and decisions were being made about what kind of interventions to happen. I think there's largely buy-in that there needs to be some sort of evaluation at the front end of things with the vast majority of juveniles. Whether we can get the individual systems that are responsible for that kid, whether that be the juvenile court or DCS, to agree that that's the case, I mean, that's where the struggle is. But I think largely people buy into the fact that there needs to be some sort of assessment. What that assessment consists of and what the what the individual pieces of testing are that comprise the protocol for the evaluation, that's where the discussion, you know, and nobody's going to debate the pencil and paper pieces of testing that are part of one of these evaluations, you know, because frankly, what they are is their standard psychological evaluations. Nobody's largely going to debate that. They're going to debate two things. They're going to debate the use of the ABLE assessment, but not as vigorously as they're going to debate the use of the polygraph. Those are the two things. I personally don't know how I do an accurate risk assessment in the absence of the information that those two measurements bring to me. I'm on record as saying I won't do a psychosexual evaluation in the absence of a polygraph and an ABLE assessment. I haven't. And thankfully, perhaps I've been able to foster relationships with defense attorneys that know my work and know that my quest is to do an objective evaluation of their client and to get their client the most appropriate treatment that they can. And I don't have the desire to have them thrown under the jail. Perhaps that's a piece of it. But I don't have attorneys who come to me saying, I'm not going to use you because you're going to do a polygraph. I don't have that happening. Now, we could have a long dialogue about why that might be. I have thoughts about that, but I don't have that resistance.
Well, but I think, Peter Maury, but I think Scott, part of the reason we're hearing you talk about that is it's not the lawyers who are coming to you that we're concerned about. It's the ones who aren't from the city. So we're trying to capture something statewide that gives us a system of uniform evaluation and uniform movement through the system. So I agree with you. I don't know how you would do it. The question is, how do we put it in there and when? Get this mandated so we get that uniform, we get at those systems that don't need to.
No, I work with a lot of the systems. I mean, Scott's the rural counties, because Maricopa is one of the ones that just kind of got rid of it when the defense attorneys had such a presence that it's just really hard to get a full polygraph. But he's talking about pre and the assessment piece, but we also needed it for the treatment piece. So it's more about all the systems. I'm sitting here telling you about the assessments coming next, and then it's just like, what do we have after that? We don't even have that.
No, I understand. And if I could, I won't be able to do justice to it because only two of us were part of the discussion yesterday in the adult subcommittee. But there's a fallacy that exists on some level out there that the pre-sentence risk assessments are not informative in the way, or that they exist for a different reason other than to assess risk and to make recommendations about appropriate level of intervention. And that kind of came up indirectly in yesterday's meeting. And I want to say that I don't know why that belief is true. I don't know where that's coming from and why there would be any belief that an assessment I or anybody else did in a pre-sentence scenario, if operating from the standpoint that they had the training and education and the experience to do the evaluation in the first place, would be anything other than an objective assessment of what's going on with the client.
Well, then, Peter Maury, I agree with you. However, I don't think that comment was aimed at you.
No, I don't think it was aimed at me at all.
Not you. Yeah. And when I say you, I don't
think yeah.
you of ethical providers who do that. But being on the defense side and having dealt with this from the prosecution and the defense, lawyers get their fingers in a lot of things before adjudication is done. And I won't go into specifics, but because of my background in psychiatry and all that, I've run a couple not so good prosecutorial evaluators out of town because I just, you know, showed how unethical they were. Same token on the defense side, I don't fish around for getting what I want, but I know other defense attorneys who will bury reports if they don't like what it says, like Ed was just talking about. So
I don't think that like evaluations that you do and other ethical evaluators are a problem. I think it's that there's too much wiggle room in the judicial system and gamesmanship that goes on before the adjudication happens. And that's why I'm, you know, put you in the fact, okay, look, this is what happens post-adjudication, pre-sentencing, when we get the evaluations done from the court, from the judicial perspective. Here's the package that have to go in and consider for sentencing that will also be used for possible treatment afterwards. Because it's not, you are worried about being unethical, it's the nature of the adversarial system. So, and I'm actually going to, is the judge still with us?
Yes.
Judge, I was just wondering if I could get your opinion on that from another legal perspective in the room.
Sure, yeah, I can tell you that the vast majority of cases I have where there is a juvenile who's accused of some kind of sexual offense is generally we do have the psychosexual done prior to disposition. Very rarely do I ever have a defense attorney object to that. Sometimes I actually have the defense attorney that wants the psychosexual done prior to adjudication because then they review the report and they reject the report prior to the county attorney seeing it. And because sometimes I have a defense attorney who thinks, hey, if my kiddo does the psychosexual, then the county attorney is going to give them a better offer. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I don't have that many kids that go through polygraphs anymore since the code changed. Generally, how that has happened is if the treatment team, you know, like I've had kids at YDI where the treatment team says, hey, we need the polygraph. They staff it with the team, including probation, and then probation will do the petition order for the polygraph with the documentation attached to it as to why they think the polygraph is necessary. And then we have a hearing about it. And, you know, sometimes the defense attorney's like, yeah, we're totally fine with that. Sometimes they battle it out, and then I have to make the decision. So that's generally how it's worked in front of me since the code change.
You know, Judge Young, you spurred something in my thinking that made me aware of something. I'm listening loudly to your comment that you don't have a lot of people, a lot of youth being polygraphed, and I think my contention would be is because, quite frankly, treatment providers, a good number of them are concerned about being blacklisted and put on the undesirable list if they were to push for and ask for polygraph in more cases, and it's kept frankly a good level of discussion from happening.
And that could be, I can't obviously speak from the treatment provider perspective. I do know you know, I've been on the juvenile bench exclusively for 13 and a half years. And so I was around before when I used to get polygraphs all the time. I used to get the sexual history polygraph. I would get, you know, incident offense polygraphs. I would get masturbatory polygraphs. I would get a ton of polygraphs initially when I was first assigned to juvenile. And then when the code change happened, initially there was a lot of discomfort, you know, I think among everybody about going away from polygraphs because we were concerned that we were going to be missing things. And I think that at some point, some treatment providers did step back from providing treatment. So I don't know what the state of the treatment providers, you know, feeling about that is. I mean, I know that, you know, I've had some kids at U-Turn where we've needed further assessment and further help with those kiddos, and we've been able to get those assessments done. So I don't know if a lot of what you know, Mel's talking about is maybe certain county specific. And you guys talked about the dismissals. We don't have that at all in Yavapai. If we've got an adjudication,
we appreciate that.
Yeah, if we've got an adjudication disposition, it's like that's the reality that we're dealing with. And, you know, we have kids do treatment, and sometimes kids are successful, sometimes they're not. I've got to say, I found that the treatment providers have done a really good job with getting good, high quality services to my kids who are on probation for sexually maladaptive behavior. So I always tell parents during hearings that, you know, we've got really, really good success rates with kids who get appropriate treatment. So it's just a matter, and I always encourage the kids, when you do your psychosexual, be super open and honest, because the best services that we can get for you, the better outcome you're going to get, because we want you to be a productive member of our community. So, yeah, it's my 2 cents worth.
Yeah, and your 2 cents worth are very valuable. I want you to hear me say that. I think the people involved hearing that from you as the representative of the court sets the tone for it being a less adversarial system, and we're trying to win some contest here where somebody else has to lose.
We want kids to grow up and be successful members of our community, you know.
So. Great. Thank you. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you so much.
And I just want to echo what you just said right there. I think that is kind of what we're looking for in our guiding principles, is we want people who have committed these offenses to eventually get back in and participate again. And sometimes I feel like the candle in a hurricane, but I think that we can't lose sight of the offenders for the victim. I mean, it's probably, I feel like I'm going to get stoned for saying that, but I think we definitely need to not lose sight of both sides of this issue.
Yeah, I'd love nothing more than for us and the larger committee, for that matter, to get to the point where we could have honest dialogues about things without people drawing conclusions and insinuations about what it was I just said. Because the reality is anybody who's doing this for the right reasons and doing a good job is concerned about everybody that's involved. They're not concerned about just one side or the other. They're concerned about the larger system. If we could all get to a place where we truly believe that and function that way, we'd be rocking and rolling.
Agreed.
So
Melanie O'Pyman, and I agree, and I mean, I get where you're coming from, Peter, but that was one of the more offensive things, and I try not to take it personal, but having loved and cared and worked with kids for as long as we have at our agency, and having good, great people that do this job, when they came out and said some of the things we were doing were abusive or coercive, it was very offensive. We care about the victims, but we absolutely care about our kids. So I just kept thinking, you know, it was just hard to wrap our heads around. How do you know how I feel about my kids or what we are doing for kids? If anything, I'm rooting for him, but letting him off the hook and know this or know that, or not knowing if the 5 other kids at home are victims, is not helping him or us or them. So it's a hard sell for some people that are like, my kid doesn't have to talk. He doesn't have to tell you anything more. He doesn't need to take a polygraph. It gets very tricky when the kid's like, I want to talk. I want to take a polygraph, which is what we ran into when it first came out. I had kids who had a defense attorneys that got the Bumby report, if you will, before the kids did, before we did. And they were telling the kid, you don't ever have to take a polygraph again. It just came out. I got a big report on my desk. And the kid came to me crying, I want to take one. I want to feel clean. I want to feel like I've told everything. My two sisters are now victims. I've told that as well. And it was really hard. It was really hard. I mean, Ben's seen it too. When you're sitting in a chair and a kid gets everything off their chest, there's nothing better than that. So when the powers that be kind of came along and said, no, it's kind of punitive, it was, I found it offensive. I was like, I guess you don't know who we are and how we operate, but I beg to differ that we are ever trying to hurt our kids.
Well, and Peter Morey, I think that's the challenge, is mental health and the legal system are by nature two different animals. And that's part of the challenge we have, is blending those two together, because one is works best in collaborative state, the mental health, in moving people forward. Legal system is set up to be adversarial by nature.
Scott Nagley here. I know John Lennon and I are dreamers, but I'm not sure that it has to be that way. In fact, I know it not to be that way in some of the outlying rural counties outside of the state of Maricopa. I know that not to be the case. And people who occupy different roles engage each other in collegial ways and trust what each other says and make some really sound decisions. So I know it's that way.
It can.
I get how it's got that way. I'm not sure it has to be that way, but that's going to require us, you know, seeking to care about what each other in this committee has to say, and in beginning to trust what each other in this committee has to say in enough of a way that we can actually forge some meaningful relationships at the front edge of this process, where there's buy-in. I just think, you know, it just has to happen. And then when people see it happening, more people see it happening. I don't think it's that simple. I'm not naive, but I don't know that it can't be that way. I think it can be that way.
I hope.
And I see it can be that way. I see evidence of it being that way. So we've successfully managed to not follow any agenda again today, which is okay and not okay, I suppose. The last thing on this agenda was a discussion about the community notification assessment. And I don't really know where to start that, but other than to say, for those of us that were in the room when the presentation was given last month, I think it's evident that a lack of evolution has taken place with respect to the instrument that's being used to make some of these decisions, and then perhaps the implementation of the decisions after scoring of whatever instrument ultimately gets used. That was evident to me. I'll just say that for what it's worth.
Peter Murray, I will completely agree with you with that 100%. But another thing I took from it is, not only are the instruments medieval at best, archaic, Stone Age, I think that in best meaning, I'm not going to try to disparage anybody here, but I think what I said an hour ago about sex offenders are easy political points, I think that some overzealous legislation has been put in place that has completely overwhelmed the resources of people who have to go out and do the notifications and get the notification assessments. And I think we've created the system, well-meaning or not, that has made it almost impossible for them to do their jobs.
Well, we've not kept up with the evolution of sex crimes. That's one thing. I mean, there's probably two levels of discussion as it relates, at least from my perspective, about community notification stuff, is whether or not, one, it was ever properly designed and built on the back of science. It wasn't. And then the second part is whether or not the instrument that we've been using, at least as far as the state of Arizona is concerned, has evolved enough to incorporate all of the kinds of offenses that are currently taking place, in particular the online offenses. And that instrument was never created for that group of people. So to leave sex crimes detectives in different municipalities with an instrument that's ill-equipped to do the task has been patently unfair.
Question, Benjamin. Did we ever get the research behind that and created it?
Oh, that's a good question.
What they were using to try and come up with these scoring system? And is every county in the state using the same one?
The answer is yes, every county in the state is using
the same on their own.
This county in level one, if I wanted to hear the...
Well, that's an iterator reliability issue right there. So, and that's a problem too.
Are we registering juveniles?
Well, some juveniles are having to register.
I think it's juveniles charged as adults.
No, it's not just juveniles charged as adults. I mean, that's why I said what I said in the meeting and asked Catherine Kretschy to comment. There are registered registration hearings in the juvenile court where some kids are required to register. Now, they're going to say those kids are aging out. That's why they're having those hearings. Those are juveniles when they committed their offenses, and they're juveniles when those questions are being asked. For treated juveniles and all those kinds of things. There's just so much to talk about there.
At a previous employment at YDI, reached out when they found out I was on the board, and there's three kids that I personally saw as a young therapist that had to register that are now getting notification, have nowhere to live, and have families. So they're going to be showing up to the Monday meeting. In fact, I need to find out how to, if it's too late for them to write in to be speakers. But now it's to me personally, these kids that are being affected that I've kind of lost track of over 30 years, but those were juveniles. Now they might've been tried as an adult, which did happen a lot more frequently back in the day. But now it really is, we have 17 year olds turning 18 that are going to registration hearings. So it will affect them.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, ma'am.
Jenna Mitchell. We had asked after the last board meeting that, or during the last board meeting, that Ms. Atkins with Department of Corrections attempt to find the validation study for the community notification assessment. She has been unable to locate that, but we do know that Dr. Gray was a part of the committee that developed that. So we are working through Dr. Blades to see if we can locate the study. In your background material packet for the board meeting on Monday, there is what DOC called a frequently asked questions document that contains some information, but it is not the validation study, which is what the board was looking for.
I have it somewhere. I just don't know where it is at this point because I haven't looked for it in so long, but I have. And as people who know me will attest, I don't throw anything out. So so it's out there, but I suspect it'll come up in the larger board meeting too, the discussion about the presentation and the instrument and all of the things that we're talking about in this room. But we have a lot of things that we need to do and eventually will do as part of this board, but that is definitely one of them that has to be attended to.
Eleni Opheim, I saw that it was in the agenda and I definitely wanted to speak at how alarming it was to go through that training and to feel for those officers having to do that, those sheriff's office. But I also didn't know if it would end up on, I figure that is going to be a bigger tackle for the larger group, if not the adult group. I didn't know if they were going to want us to be doing something nuts and bolts with that. You know, I mean, I'm glad it's on the agenda, but I figure we don't have to worry about that.
Yeah, well, my sense is we're still trying to figure out what we do have to be worried about in our individual spaces, this larger process.
My God, it seems like a big task for everybody to handle.
It is, and I, Peter Maury, I agree with Scott. You know, he and I are, and I think Blake are the three that are on both subcommittees, so it's turning into a wrestling match on the adult subcommittee too, but I don't want to speak for Scott, but I think personally that it's not something that we can ignore on either subcommittee. And I know there's some rumblings that I've heard personally about, okay, we don't want to deal with registration or notification. That's not going to affect anybody, but it is. I mean, from a treatment provider perspective, we all know that registration and notification is always going to be in the background for treatment. And you can't do treatment without recognizing that massive elephant in the room in their life, because it comes down to housing, it comes down to employment, it comes down to all that. So I think as a board, we need to be very aware of registration and notification as construct what we're trying to construct.
Now, Neil, I totally agree with you. I just didn't know if it was for us four to tackle. I feel like there's 10 agenda items that come before
one out of 50 kids that might have to register for my age is a privilege.
But I think we need to plant the seeds.
Well, and
I just figure, I didn't think that was going to be the first thing we're going to tackle as a juvenile committee, because it's huge. That's all I'm saying.
I mean, it can't be first, I agree.
Scott Nagley commenting on something I think I heard you say, Peter, but whatever rumblings are happening about, that's not going to be something that the board tackles. We either are a sex offender management board in a comprehensive way, or we're not.
Right.
I know we live in a political world. I'm painfully aware of that on a daily basis. But I don't think we can carve out things that we say we're going to attend to and ignore other things. I don't know how we do that. I don't know how I do that in good conscience.
Well, and if I can clarify that a little bit, I mean, we are going to tackle it as the big board. We're mandated to by the statute, but specifically with the adult subcommittee, yeah. It was kind of rumbling that as a subcommittee.
No, I think I'm not as good as Brecken probably is at keeping the herd of cats moving in a straight line. And we do have to do things, as Mel's alluding to, sooner rather than later versus other things. I just don't want us to forget to revisit the issues. That's all I'm speaking to. And to remember what I think this board was founded to do. More to follow on that. I guess I make an announcement regarding the next couple of meetings. We are in the process of, and I think we have confirmed part of this for sure, that at our next meeting, we're looking to have two presentations done by probably more than one person, a small group probably from DCS, talking about their process as it relates to kids with these issues and families with these issues, and then also have somebody from the Maricopa County Juvenile Probation Department give a similar kind of thing. Those will be 30 to 45 minutes each, I think. So it will probably eat a good chunk of our next meeting, but that's okay. In the interim of us talking about having those folks come, I reached out to the psychologist that has been here from the Department of Juvenile Corrections, who is in charge of the program at the Adobe Mountain School, if he would be willing to do similarly for us. And he said he would, but we're looking to have him do that in May. So with good fortune, we have two folks coming to speak to us next time. And then the psychologist from ADJC to do similarly at the May meeting.
And I'm glad that DCS and probation will be here in the same day, quite frankly.
That they will be here in the same day. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Make a motion for adjournment of the meeting.
I second the motion.
Meeting is adjourned.
All in favor?
Oh, aye. Sorry. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Thank you for that.